This week on Behind the Lens.
Get it out there. It's coming back.
More than a week after the Crescent City Connection incident, New Orleans police chief faces tough questions at city council. We'll hear from that special meeting. We'll also examine the prospects for police reform with two law enforcement experts, Ursula Price and Raphael Guaneschi. Also, a new survey of New Orleans students supports the idea that the educational experience is split badly along racial lines. We'll explore it in detail. And an update from a former member of the crew of Nix. She's made a painful decision to leave after all. I'm Tom Bright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. Welcoming our listeners on partner radio stations 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. The city of New Orleans joins the rest of the state Saturday in phase two of Louisiana's COVID-19 response. More residents and visitors this weekend will enjoy somewhat looser restrictions on restaurant capacity, for instance, and finally get back to some of their favorite watering holes. And as they do, there's a fair chance that the Black Lives Matter protests here and across the country will be a topic for discussion. NOPD's response to the protests remained in full focus this week. Police Superintendent Sean Ferguson corrected his earlier statement that only tear gas canisters were shot into the crowd on June 3rd at the Crescent City Connection. He acknowledged some officers fired rubber-coated projectiles as well. It's not clear who gave that order, and the incident remains under investigation both internally and before the city council itself. Michael Isaac Stein reports.
The city council called a special meeting this week to specifically get answers about what happened on the Crescent City Connection, you know, what led to the deployment of tear gas. I mean, this is the first time the NOPD has used tear gas on a crowd in decades. The council, you know, asked Superintendent Sean Ferguson and a couple other witnesses when the last time we'd even used tear gas before was, and no one really had a clear answer. It seems to be, you know, beyond the living memory of current public safety officials even. So, you know, the question was to try and clarify, you know, why the NOPD did what it did that night. And, you know, was it appropriate and are there changes that need to be made?
Michael, some of the discussion I monitored in this hearing focused on questions about the use of tear gas during a pandemic. Here is Councilman Jason Williams questioning Police Chief Sean Ferguson. Let's listen.
Obviously, I've got serious questions with regards to deployment of them on the bridge, deployment of on them in a crowd when only part of the crowd is causing the problem, because obviously there's a difference between a crowd and a riot. Will the investigation delve into, and are you looking into the deployment of tear gas, which causes respiratory distress during a COVID-19 crisis? Individuals who, whether or not they were socially distancing or not, obviously if it causes coughing and wheezing, and respiratory distress with eyes and whatever, and for officers and for citizens, it would appear that that would could exacerbate the COVID-19 situation as well, the use of that material. What are your thoughts?
I mean, that very well could be the case. Our number one priority at that point in time was the safety of everyone and trying to get everyone off of that bridge.
We hear there from Mr. Williams. What about the other council members and their questions to the chief in this hearing? Were they also especially pointed in their interrogation?
Yeah, nearly all the council members maintained a very skeptical tone throughout the questioning. And you know, Chief Ferguson, he was on a lot of these answers. He was saying, you know, we got to wait for this use of force investigation to be done. You know, I'm not going to make a judgment call on whether tear gas was the right tool in that moment. However, there was one point of contention, you know, that kind of took up the most time and I thought was maybe the most interesting. And it was the question of whether the NOPD should have set up a blockade in the middle of this bridge at all. You know, the question being, you know, once people were already on the bridge, why not just let them, you know, cross over to the West Bank and walk back as they said they were going to do? And, you know, Chief Ferguson has, you know, put out a number of explanations about these, but, you know, the council kind of really did not let him off the hook when some of these explanations weren't really lining up, you know, with their interpretation of that evening.
Surely, as the council deliberates whether to continue to allow the use of tear gas and some of the other crowd control methods that NOPD says it has in its toolkit, we should remind ourselves that this is just the beginning of what is likely to be a long process of examining reforms, both with law enforcement at the local level and in other ways. What is this council going to be looking at in the weeks and months to come?
There are some like simple reforms they're looking at. You know, for example, right now it turns out we don't have, the NOPD doesn't have a written protocol on when they can use tear gas or rubber balls on, you know, a crowd. So, you know, that's, you know, one simple area that was identified pretty early on as a place for change. But I think that to a lot of at least the protesters who have been out, that is not really where the conversation is. I think nationally, the conversation, you know, among people who want the most change, you know, the people who are out protesting the most against police violence, the conversation seems to have shifted from reform to the complete restructuring of how we see public safety and how, you know, cities, you know, look after the public safety interests of their citizens. So the conversation has turned not only to, you know, creating more reforms and restrictions on the police, but questioning, number one, you know, do we need a police department at least of this size at all? You know, should the same city agency that responds to a hostage situation, should that be the same agency that responds to a drug overdose? You know, so kind of questioning why we, you know, have this, you know, militarized force that is in charge of so many sections of public safety. You know, how that conversation is going to actually develop here, it'll be interesting to see. Jason Williams, Councilman Jason Williams, has set up or is trying to set up an advisory committee to look at NOPD funding and maybe how that could be shifted. But again, I think that discussion is going to go on for a while. But first, it seems pretty vital that before we start talking about reforms, that we kind of establish whether the NOPD acted appropriately on the CCC bridge that night. It seems like before we get to a common understanding on that, it'll be hard to see, you know, what reforms we collectively believe need to be made.
Michael Isaac Stein covers city politics and government issues. He was on the Crescent City Connection Wednesday before last when the tear gas flew. He's well, uninjured, and thankfully able to continue his excellent coverage for the Lens and for you. Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
We want to spend some time this week talking about what happened on the Triple C, but also the broader and much more complex topic of police reform. Ursula Price can help us there. She is the former deputy police monitor, part of the federally decreed oversight program for NOPD. Price currently is executive director for the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice.
It is interesting that the day after, everyone was giving NOPD a lot of credit and asking how New Orleans managed to maintain the peace, that the peace was broken. I think that just exemplifies that the work the community has done with their police department isn't over and that we have to remain vigilant. And I think this fit very well with the consent decree monitor's finding that NOPD is not engaging in close supervision. The fact that they are speculating as to why someone used the projectile and not sure who issued the order, and that they don't have a clear explanation the moment that it occurred lets me know that this was not well coordinated through all the chains of supervision. In addition to that, I would say, as just a human being, I want my police officers to not make fear-based decisions. And when you are a part of an armed, well-equipped force facing a group of civilians, their safety should be just as high a concern as your own personal safety. Honestly, I find it hard to believe that they were more afraid of the crowd than the crowd was afraid of them, that they were the ones holding the gun.
Let me note that the police might argue in response that what they did in terms of using non-lethal tactics, non-lethal tools such as tear gas, such as rubber ball projectile use, that they were very much conscious of the need to protect life, and that ultimately the protest itself on a major traffic artery through the metro area was in fact a threat to public safety.
I guess my response to that is your community doesn't agree with you, NLPD. You did, in fact, do physical harm to a number of people. And I have heard no evidence that that group of protesters did any physical harm to anyone. You have managed to deal with them blocking traffic for several days in a row without incident. So that's not enough of a public safety consideration to merit physical force, in my opinion. And I think what you're seeing now is that a lot of people disagree with you that using things that cause serious physical harm are appropriate in this kind of situation. It's great that you didn't kill anyone. I'm asking for a higher standard. Can you actually protect this community instead of avoiding murdering it?
Ultimately, the question that is raised in this incident and many others, what are the valid uses of force by a law enforcement agency charged with maintaining law and order in the public? When is use of force appropriate by those officers in a case where they're certainly outnumbered by a large crowd of vocally angry protesters, let alone some of the people who actually charged the lines that night on the bridge? When is force appropriate?
That's a valid question. First of all, I'd like to point out there is a concept called strategic retreat, in which officers simply pull back and regroup to maintain control of the situation. And the courts have been clear that when an officer is facing a physical threat, that force is justified. I think that this community, this national community, is questioning some of the court's wisdom because the court allows the officer's perception of threat to be the standard. And people are looking for more objective measures. In this particular situation, I can understand why officers felt threatened. And that's why we have supervision that can zoom out and assess the situation more strategically than someone sitting on the front lines in an intense situation. If you ask me, this situation occurred because officers were acting without coordination.
We saw very, very large rallies and marches Thursday and Friday. Those were peaceful. Police appeared to have maintained a large presence themselves that was not in the face, if you will, of the protesters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of staging on Canal Street, for instance, Friday. Did those negotiators, so to speak, on both sides, were they ultimately able to regroup? Were they able to reestablish productive lines of communication, in your view, given what we saw in the late part of the week?
You know, it's hard for me to say. My organization wasn't involved in organizing those protests, nor were we directly participating except as individuals. So it's hard to say. But I do know that when there is communication between march organizers and the police, things go better. Certainly they do in our marches. And we don't always disagree. We don't always agree on what should be the course of action, but there's never – all confrontations are usually resolved because we communicate. So I do wonder if communication broke down on the night that police force was used. Having said that, I do think that it is incumbent upon the police department to make sure those lines of communication are open to avoid this very situation of them having to make a choice between their own safety and the safety of the community they're sworn to protect. I do not believe that this is a situation where there was a threat from one civilian to another. This was purely about police feeling that their control of the situation was threatened. And in that situation, it's incumbent upon them to make sure that they are communicating before they act rashly.
Finally, I want your thoughts, Ursula, about, and I'm not sure if it's simply the flavor of the week, to be honest with you, when it comes to national news media, but the refrain, that call to defund the police.
Yeah.
To refocus and in many cases restructure, rebuild police departments. What does that look like? What is a refocus, retooling for more community-oriented policing mean?
Yeah, I think the conversation is totally valid and timely. It is a fact that even police agree there are a number of functions we ask our police departments to perform that are not appropriate. Police are not good at responding to mental health crises. Police are not great at dealing with domestic violence. Police are not equipped to, honestly, our police aren't even great at traffic accident investigations. These are all things that other communities have decided to not resource their police department to address. So first of all, there's a large category of things we ask police departments to do and fund them to do that they don't do well and don't really want to do. Second of all, there are a lot of models of how to provide for public safety around the world that don't strictly rely on armed police officers, but instead network police departments with larger systems of social support, including trained mental health professionals. And third, I think that everyone has a valid concern that not just our city, but most cities spend a huge chunk of their budget on public safety systems that aren't meeting their needs. That there's no performance standards tied to this funding, and that as police departments get in trouble, they tend to get more funding. So the worse they do their job, the more resources they are given. All of these things are indicators of changes that we can make. This community has been asking for over a decade that the city council tie performance to funding with the New Orleans Police Department, and yet we've yet to see that actually occur. In fact, we are not yet even getting reliable data from the police department about its performance, about its there's still controversy about whether or not police reports and crime numbers are accurate. And on top of that, we have a really vibrant opportunity to be creative about how we want to provide safety in our community. I was very impressed. I'm not from New Orleans. I grew up in Mississippi. And when I moved here, I was very impressed by some of the models that I saw in the St. Thomas area that were provided documented reductions in crime that weren't just based on the police. They were based on community public safety, on models like peacekeepers and block captains. and conflict resolution. The truth of the matter is, I think we have ample evidence of ways to keep our communities safe that work better than armed police officers. But we've never made the investment in making those conversions. Now is our opportunity to do that. These conversations have been happening for a long time, and the solutions are documented. But we have to actually engage them, and we actually have to be committed to a shift in power. If we want policing to work for this whole community, then we can't put all the power in the hands of the police. Absolute power is corrupting, right?
That's what I hear. We certainly thank you again. Ursula Price with the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Always.
We also spoke this week with Rafael Guaneschi. He leads the nonprofit Metropolitan Crime Commission. Guaneschi insists that police must be able to use force responsibly to protect themselves and the public, but he remains an advocate for accountability and substantial reforms in the police department.
Law enforcement is no different in the perspective of racism. They're not immune from racism, just as no other profession, no other segment of society is immune from it. But when you see law enforcement engage in racist, inappropriate conduct, it is something that really resonates with the public. Now, police are under a microscope. They are viewed as the agency in the community that's supposed to be administering justice and helping people. And when you see examples and instances where they fail, it is alarming to everybody, particularly people of color, because many of the calls for service and many of the encounters that we see on video, and we're having, you know, hearing stories being related now, involve people of color in law enforcement. So this is, now I've been around a while, and I think that this is one of the significant events that is going to initiate change. You know, seen it with the Danziger Bridge situation after Katrina and some of the investigations there. We've seen, you know, the final or the Danziger Bridge and some of those other situations resulted in a consent decree. We're about 8 years into the consent decree. And I think that what happened with Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis is a national wake-up call. You know, the Danziger Bridge was a wake-up call for the city of New Orleans and the New Orleans Police Department. The George Floyd Minneapolis tragedy is a wake-up call for the nation. So now, as a nation, I think we're starting to recognize some of the disconnect, some of the problems. We're hearing decades of frustration and anger emerging. And I think that this is long overdue. And I think some real dialogue is taking place right now. It needs to continue right now. We're at the stage where the public is expressing their views, and the community, government, law enforcement is listening. So at some point, the community and law enforcement need to sit down and figure out how they move forward and improve the situation, because that's what everyone wants, including law enforcement. But there are problems and impediments that law enforcement has in initiating some of these changes. And the public needs to understand what those are. They need to understand the limitations and how some of the governmental decisions that are made at the state level in the name of saving money are adversely impacting the law enforcement agencies that have taken an oath to enforce the laws that are passed at the Louisiana legislature. This is long overdue, and I think it could be really a allow us to launch some long overdue reforms that will serve our state, our city, and our nation, and make us better for it going forward. So this is an opportunity, and I think that law enforcement is welcoming the dialogue and working to be a better partner to the community going forward.
Just talk a little bit about how difficult it really will be to defund police without supporting the services that we've been asking them to provide.
Right. So keep in mind, fundamentally, the police are employed to protect and serve. And the indicator of how heavily City of New Orleans relies on the police department is on the city's website. You can see calls for service that citizens dial 911 and engage the police. So since January of this year, which of course includes, it's May, so it's January and February pre-COVID-19 and March, April, May post-COVID-19. There were, in January, 34,827 calls for service that went to the police department. And the low water mark was 32,690 in April. And, you know, the police are understaffed. They don't have the manpower to respond to all the calls for service, much less do everything else that's expected of police. So you're dealing with, and this is sort of what I was alluding to, the people that are calling for defunding the police need to understand what the community calls the police to do and keep in mind that, you know, the police didn't make the laws, the legislature made the laws. The police didn't defund programs, you know, for mental health services. That was done at the state level. So if you don't have mental health treatment and somebody that used to be able to control their mental health issues with medications doesn't have access to those medications and they commit a crime and police get called to the scene, they have to deal with those individuals. So some of the decisions that are made above the level of the police, you know, by the legislative or executive branches of government. So the state saves some money, but it's costing cities and the parishes more money, and that responsibility falls to the police. You know, in a money-saving measure, it used to be two-man police cars. Now it's one-man police cars. So the police workload has increased. The technology that's being involved and the consent decree with the paperwork that's being required to be filled out means that, you know, the police are buried under a mountain of paperwork and literally just responding from one call for service to the next, where essentially those calls for services need to be triaged and prioritized. So when the public dials 911 and the police take 2 hours, 4 hours, don't show up that day, the public views it as the police not caring. The public views it as the police maybe sitting down in a donut shop and they don't realize that they don't have the resources to respond to all of the demands that are being made on them. So, you know, people that are calling for defunding the police department, I think they don't truly understand what we're asking police to do. So in the light of the COVID in the city and the declining revenue, the police department is going to have to cut their budget like everybody else. So what is being suggested is cut the civilian staff from the police department, and you still have uniform officers. But that civilian staff did work that has to be done for the police department to be able to function. So that work still has to be done, and it'll be done by commissioned police officers. So that'll further reduce the available officers to do fundamental police work in all of this. And we've made those decisions before there was a COVID. You know, anytime that there were some budgetary crises in the city, there would be, let's cut back here, let's cut back there. And that absolutely reduces the police department's ability to respond. So if, you might remember a couple of years ago, there was a major focus in an investigation by the IG's office, and the news media made a point of showing how long it was taking police to respond to calls for service. And that was at a time that the police department was down about 500 officers from where they were 5 years ago. Those cutbacks absolutely affect the police department's ability to protect and serve. And the people that are dialing 911 are having a crisis, and they expect police to come. And when they don't come, they're not blaming the city or the state, they're blaming the police department for that. So I think that, you know, the police department can, and I'm talking about nationally, you know, police departments need to listen to what's happening. The New Orleans Police Department, I think, has come light years from where they were pre-Katrina to where we are today. That doesn't mean that we can declare victory and it's over or that's good enough. The objective is perfection. And you never stop striving for that. I've seen it happen where politicians, you know, said that we wanted to reform the department, and then they declared victory because progress had been made. And when they declared victory, they stopped the push to improve. And if you're not improving, you're getting worse, you're backsliding. We don't want to see that happen. This is a never-ending process.
Rafael Coinashi with the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafael, I can't thank you enough.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Anytime.
Looking at education news, the Orleans Parish School Board has a new member, albeit an interim one. The board also says they will examine prospects for a racial equity plan. Marta Jusen has that.
On Thursday afternoon, the Orleans Parish School Board selected Grisella Jackson to fill what's going to be a 7-month vacancy that will be created when Ben Kleben leaves mid-month. Ms. Jackson is a local businesswoman who came here from Puerto Rico when she was 8, not speaking English, so she, you know, highly praises the public education system here. She helped reopen Crocker Elementary School after Hurricane Katrina, and has been heavily involved in education, at the official level on a charter school board, and then also like through her church and providing tutoring services.
Okay, welcome to her. And the board Thursday afternoon also discussed development of a racial equity plan. Tell me what the idea is there, and what specifically the board wants to look at.
So this plan is going to examine a variety of things, everything from policies that are written into the school board, and then also at the school level, down to, you know, whether or not the district sees racial disparities in its hiring or retention or compensation of its own central office employees. It's also going to look at things such as whether they should provide something called Know Your Rights training to students and whether or not academic and tutoring services, also special education services that are provided to kids are appropriate and, you know, reflect and take into account their culture and their background and what those things, what specific needs those might add to what they need as a student, basically, to be healthy and safe. The one big question in this plan is whether or not it is going to involve charter schools. Charters basically get to set their own policies. In this resolution, the board is encouraging its charter schools to do a similar review, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to do such a thing.
I know you will keep an eye on that, and I thank you for it. Marta Jusen, reporting on Education Affairs for The Lens.
A bit more about those racial inequities in the classroom. The Education Research Alliance for New Orleans surveyed about 4,000 public school students in our city. They found many disparities in how students of different races view their teachers, their schools, and their relationship with the police. Lindsay Wexler is with the Education Research Alliance, and she's a co-author of this survey report. We spoke with her and one of the key advisors in this effort, Dr. Rashida Govan, with the New Orleans Youth Alliance.
I mean, I think one of the things that's missing in our landscape is the student's perspective on their experiences in NOLA public schools. Like, we've researched parents, we've heard from school leaders. We had not really heard from the young people directly about how they've experienced schools, but also or how what their experiences were like in general, because the state doesn't really afford us that opportunity. We're one of the places that is not allowing like one of these national surveys into schools to give us insight on how young people's experiences. So we really wanted to know what their like engagement looked like. What are they doing with their time? How do they feel about their experiences? What's their relationship with their teachers? What are their aspirations? We really wanted to know who our kids were and what they were thinking, because I think that voice has been missing from a lot of the advocacy work that has been going on in New Orleans public schools or with respect to New Orleans public schools.
Let's look at how these students view their learning environment and a range of other factors. Lindsay, what are the top line results from this large survey of students here in Orleans Parish?
Sure. Yeah, we asked students, in broad categories, we asked students about their perceptions of their teachers, their school climate, and their experiences in their neighborhoods. And a couple of big takeaways. I think one of the big stories here is the differences in the way that Black and white students answered these questions, with a very clear pattern of white students reporting more positive experiences in their schools with their teachers and to some extent in their neighborhoods as well. I think another big takeaway for me is that there's just a lot of variation in the average levels of how positively students view things. So there were some bright spots. For example, students reported feeling challenged by their teachers at high levels and with no racial disparity in that particular outcome. But then we saw a really low level of agreement with teachers being able to manage their classrooms well, and a big racial disparity there. So it really varied by the specific domain. And then the third takeaway, one thing that was challenging for us was finding good comparison data to try to gauge, you know, now we have a good sense of what New Orleans students are experiencing and how that varies by race, but we don't have a great sense of how that compares to a national benchmark or to other similar cities. What we did get some national comparison data on the teacher rating components, and we did see New Orleans students across the board rating their teachers lower than what was in the national comparison sample. So that I think that raises a concern.
On school climate, generally you write that students seem to agree school discipline is fair. Bullying is not a problem. But roughly a third of students in on each of those topics do not feel that discipline is fair and do feel like bullying is a problem. And students of color tended to report lower ratings than their white counterparts on a lot of these aspects. Rashida, if I may ask, just on that finding alone, are any surprise to that? Are what's your reaction?
I mean, I think my reaction was similar to yours. I'm not necessarily surprised about the data on bullying. I'm certainly not surprised about the sense of school safety, and not because of necessarily our young people in particular, like there's something wrong with them, but it is, there's this piece around trauma that we haven't really kind of discussed widely. I mean, I think we're beginning to discuss it more, but when you're looking at, if you begin to look at the economic data on young people, and there's some mental health data and ACEs data or Adverse Childhood Experiences data that the Institute for Women and Ethnic Studies, they are on the steering committee, that they put out, it indicates that students of color in our schools are really experiencing high levels of trauma. Many of them have post-traumatic stress disorder. Many of them have been witnesses to violence. And all of that kind of stuff really can impact the way that a young person shows up in a school building. So when I see things like bullying, that's not a surprise to me that young people who have experienced trauma may be, in fact, perpetuating like bullying in that school or perpetrating bullying. I think about also like the classroom management data in particular. A lot of our teachers have not been trained in trauma-informed strategies. And so I think even to with their best effort, are not able to meet the needs of our young people of color who are experiencing trauma. I think this finding is particularly important in the context of COVID-19, where adverse childhood experiences like loss of employment for a parent, loss of a person in your immediate family, food insecurity, and all of those things are adverse childhood experiences that impact the mental health, cognitive, and social development of young people. I think that we are going to continue to see more of that if we don't respond by preparing those who are working with young people to be more trauma-informed. So I think this survey is really important. I think this data tells us some of what we know, but it really means something different when we hear it from young people directly.
Students' views on their teachers seem to be another case in point of that disconnect that we're seeing in a lot of these data.
As I mentioned before, that students on average rated their teachers pretty high in challenging them. That was one of the few bright spots. We did see racial disparities in 4 out of the 7 of these categories. And a couple of them were ones that I think really hit home at the kind of systemic discrimination that Black students are experiencing. Black students were much less likely to say that they felt like their teachers valued their ideas and encouraged their views than white students. We saw 74% of white students in the survey saying that they felt like their teachers valued their ideas, and I thought that was pretty telling. You know, I think there's Rashida was talking about need for teacher training. One thing we know about our workforce in public schools in New Orleans is that it tends to be less experienced. And has become less experienced over the last decade or so. And teaching is really, really hard. It's really challenging. And I think teachers, especially new teachers, need support and training on classroom management and on building relationships with students, which really go hand in hand. I think classroom management is really founded on having good relationships with your students, which then feeds into students feeling valued in the classroom and feeling that connection. So I completely agree with Rashida in thinking about both specific training for some of the issues our students are facing and just more general support for learning how to do this profession well.
Yeah, I would like to just echo that, because I think the one data point in that particular category on their ratings of their teachers that really like struck me was the piece on care, and less than half of African-American students felt that their teachers cared for them showed care for their emotional well-being. Goes back to my whole piece around trauma-informed practice. I don't know that this translates to teachers don't care. I think they don't know how to express or exhibit care in instances when a situation may be very challenging for them that a young person is going through. Regardless, we have to show up and demonstrate compassion and love for our children and kind of take on some of the tough stuff if we intend for them to show up and take on some of the tough stuff academically. For me, one of the things that stood out was the data point on police safety and students feeling safer in the presence of police. That was actually kind of a startling data point for me, like to know that our young people don't feel safe in the presence of police, particularly African Americans. I mean, we're seeing 40% of them reporting that. And given what is happening right now in this in the country, I think this is something that's worth examining. And I think the presence of law enforcement in our schools is something that we have to look at. If 40% of African American students and our schools feel safer around them, and they're in many of our schools, this is a bit of an issue to me that I think that we need to consider. And in terms of what to do with the data, this actually is a really a strong data point that for those who are advocating for eliminating police roles in schools. So I think that one stood out for me quite a bit. I think that's something that is worth noting. I think one of the other things that stood out for me quite a bit was on aspirations. And certainly we know nationally, many and most students aspire to go to college. Most students are very eager and excited about that. I thought it was very telling, though, that regardless of their aspirations, many African-Americans had, well, African-Americans had less of a belief that it's likely that they'll get a degree. And quite honestly, when you look at the data, there it's the truth. They're less likely to be retained in college. And if you look at Louisiana's college retention rates, they're pretty abysmal. So I think that is very interesting. And it goes along with some other data that I've been seeing about like life expectancy and health outcomes. Like those who are able to attain a college degree are usually have higher outcomes in those in the way of wages and health outcomes and life expectancy. But in Louisiana, as a state, we've seen increases in college enrollment and high school graduation rates, but it is not panning out the higher wages for African Americans, nor is it panning out the like longer life expectancy. We in fact have significantly lower life expectancy than our counterparts across all races, racial demographics. So I think this tells me that young people are aware that our investment in these systems is not generating the same outcomes as it is for other populations, which goes back to what we're seeing across the board, that white students are having a markedly different experience in the education system than African American students.
One other thing that I want to highlight is just looking across the pattern of results. Rashida mentioned the high aspirations that Black students have for college going. We also saw no racial disparity in how much students say they value education, how much that they believe that putting effort in matters. We saw the racial disparity go in the opposite direction when we asked students themselves about their own social engagement. So we saw Black students about twice as likely as white students to say that they're engaged in some sort of social organization outside of school. We saw them saying they were more likely to contributing in their community, volunteering in some way, more likely than white students to say that. So these elements that the students have control over themselves, we're not seeing the same kind of racial disparity. Where we're seeing the disparity are in things that students don't have control over, you know, how well their teachers are managing their classroom, how much their teachers value them, how safe they feel in school. The narrative is not that there's some issue with the students themselves leading to these outcomes. Like the story very clearly points to having the same value in education, the same aspirations, and yet having all of these barriers in place that make it very challenging. As Rashida said, the reality is very different from the self-reported aspirations for college in this survey. We see 85% or so of students saying they want to, they think they will get to and through college, when in reality in Louisiana, it's closer to half or less.
And I think part of what troubles me most about this survey is that while the American institution of public education is by and large available to all in this day and age, from the student's perspective at least, we still have a system of separate but unequal educational experiences. What do these survey results tell you in terms of reasonable policies, practical solutions for the sort of disparities that we sense our students experiencing on at the classroom level?
Well, from my perspective, I think the really obvious piece is around, as I mentioned before, just professional development for educators on trauma-informed practice, and also like just the shift in the culture. I think one of the items in here talked about the growth mindset, and it was like basically an equal outcome for whites and African American students. Like they both have like a high level of like adoption of a growth mindset, and that's been kind of pushed heavily in our school systems. But this idea of care and compassion and love has not been a central feature, and it matters. And there's a ton of research that talks about the importance of relationships in facilitating learning for young people and in promoting positive academic outcomes for students. So I'd have to go back to this professional development around trauma-informed practice and around just professional development that emphasizes like relationship, the development of relationships. I think that is important. Might sound crazy, but it really does, for me, seem like something that from a policy standpoint, at least on the trauma side, like that is an important piece that's included in teacher prep programs and professional development across the city. I think that is a big one. Taking law enforcement out of our schools, that is another big one, something that we've been discussing for quite some time. I think we should be looking at, there's some pieces in the survey that talk about students' perceptions of their actual buildings, like where they're going to school and how well kept they are and things. We see disparities there. I think it would be important to look at where our white students are attending schools versus our black students. And nationally, African American students in urban sectors are going to schools that are older the buildings are not as well kept. That is not a secret. That is something that we should be looking at. And certainly that was a kind of surprising to me a little bit, because a lot of our schools have been renovated post-Katrina, but I think it's something worth examining. From a policy standpoint, something I've been pushing for a long time that I think aligns with some of what we found here are those disparities in the experiences, specifically around access to high-level curriculum. So in a lot of our schools, our students who are students of color don't have, well, primarily African-American students, don't have the same access to AP courses and physics and calculus and all of those courses that are linked to higher college readiness than their peers at white, majority white schools. Mm-hmm. Something is wrong with that. And even at schools that have it, African-Americans are underrepresented.
The other thing that I think is worth thinking about is how we enable real access to all schools for all children in the city. Most schools, but not all, are open enrollment. But just being open enrollment doesn't mean that everyone has real access in terms of where schools are located around the city, what the transportation system looks like. And we know that white students and more affluent students cluster in particular schools that they think are the better schools or better fits for them. And I think making sure that students of color and low-income students really have real access to the schools that they want to be in is one thing that we should be thinking about and talking about at a city level.
We leave it there. Lindsay Wexler with the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans, and Dr. Rashida Govan with the New Orleans Youth Alliance. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to read more on the findings, you can find a link to the report on the page for this podcast at thelensnola.org. Last week, we spoke with a member of the crew of Nyx about her decision to stay with the parade organization. Now, this is coming after crew captain Julie Lee posted an All Lives Matter graphic on Instagram. It was widely panned as tone deaf and insensitive amid the Black Lives Matter protest. And not long after that interview, Julie Lee rejected demands from several lieutenants to resign. Yet more members have left the crew, and our next guest, Amanda Hearn, decided to reconsider her membership.
A lot's happened and not a lot's happened, ironically. Sisters within the organization have protested rightfully the insensitivity and the ignorance of the post that Julie Lee made. And I am one of the people who had an amazing float for 4 years, just wonderful women and the experiences we had. And when I said I was going to stay, it was because I wanted to fight for that. But day after day after day, Julie Lee has said nothing, has not reached out, issued her canned apology, which she then removed, and she's been silent. And her silence speaks louder than that stupid Instagram post she made. And the more she doesn't speak, the more loudly she lets us know she doesn't care. Entire floats have quit, and I cannot reiterate, we knew there was a level of shadiness, but because the crew and the women that we are and the relationships that we built, we overlooked it, just like every other crew. But this watershed that she allowed, you know, we can't look the other way anymore. When I said I was going to stay, I got support because I think people understood that I was fighting for my sisters and the experiences and everything that we had. And that's from a place of emotion. I am fiercely loyal. I'm dedicated. That was my initial reaction once I was able to step back and look at everything in a pragmatic frame of mind. There's no way that I could stay. And when I announced that I was leaving, literally everyone to a person was like, I know how hard this was for you. Nobody was snarky. Nobody, like, with maybe two exceptions, was like, you should have known better. Everyone was like, I know what this crew meant to you. I know what your sisters meant to you. And I know how difficult this decision was for you. And we are so, so sorry that this person did this. She destroyed something she built. And it's heartbreaking because Nyx was an amazing parade. It was a beloved parade. It was a spectacular. I mean, Nyx was voted most popular parade so many years in a row. I mean, it was beautiful and memorable. But, you know, behind the shiny curtain, you know, that's not sustainable.
That's Amanda Hearn speaking with us Thursday. We thank her for her time. That's all for now. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.